People are correct when they think they're real, but where they're wrong is where they think they're really real.
Herzlich willkommen bei Meditation, Coaching in Life. Wie ihr hört, begrüßt euch ein sehr heiserer Michael Kurt, auch bekannt als Curse. In der heutigen Folge spreche ich mit einem großartigen Lehrer von mir, aber nicht nur von mir, sondern von ganz vielen Menschen. Robert Thurman war einer der ersten Westler, die nach Indien gegangen sind, um beim Dalai Lama selbst und vielen anderen Lehrern den tibetischen Buddhismus zu lernen. Er war der erste Amerikaner, der erste Westler, den der Dalai Lama zum Mönch ordiniert hat. Ganz abgesehen davon war Robert Thurman Universitätsprofessor, Autor von vielen, vielen Büchern und einer der lustigsten und am meist wissenden Lehrer in diesem ganzen Feld. Ich habe das große, große Glück gehabt, Robert Thurman oder Bob oder Tenzin Bob, wie ihn seine Freunde genannt haben, kennenzulernen, mit ihm Zeit zu verbringen, bei ihm zu lernen und den ein oder anderen sehr guten Tipp von ihm zu bekommen. Vor einigen Wochen ist Bob Thurman leider verstorben. Aber seine Lehren und sein Humor und sein Wissen werden andauern. Um davon ein kleines bisschen auch mit euch zu teilen, haben wir eine Art Best-of zusammengeschnitten aus meiner Podcast-Folge mit Bob aus dem Jahr 2020. Bob redet vor allem darüber, wie wir es schaffen, auch bei großer Anstrengung und in politisch sehr unsteten Zeiten nicht den Mut zu verlieren, nicht die Hoffnung zu verlieren, sondern mit Freude und mit Power und mit Energy und mit großem Herz weiter für die gute Sache einzustehen. Das war eine von Bobs größten und wichtigsten Botschaften und ich freue mich, die nochmal mit euch zu teilen, denn das, was er da erzählt, das können wir alle gar nicht oft genug hören. In diesem Sinne, viel Freude mit dieser neuen Folge und Bob Thurman, wir werden uns wiedersehen.
Okay.
I see if everything's running. Yes, that looks good.
All right.
Perfect.
Okay.
All right, perfect. Thank you very much for doing this.
My pleasure, Mike. It's great to have you here.
I appreciate it. It's so the podcast is called Meditation, Coaching and Life, so we can talk about anything because the word life is in there. So
life is there.
So coaching, anything.
You said meditation, coaching?
Yes.
Okay.
And life. So.
All right. Coaching and life.
Yes. And I wanted to, another question I had before, a little bit more concrete, maybe.
Yeah.
That maybe has something to do with emptiness.
Okay, good.
Is the question now, a lot of people want to make the world a better place, right? They want to change the world.
Right.
So they get into social action.
Yes.
They get into, you know, they become very righteous about things and so on and so on.
Right.
But a lot of people like that. They burn out or they become very angry or they become very disillusioned or something.
Yes.
So, what is your thought on that? As you're talking about Buddhism is, would be a vehicle to,
or like, an education.
Yeah.
It's an education. You see, Westerners have not wanted to encounter it as an education because Westerners think they're smarter than everybody else. And that those Asian people, well, they're kind of cool and they meditate, they look cute. And they have their cute Buddha that we can put in the garden, you know, and feel calm with the Buddha's there. But basically, we have nothing to learn from them.
Yeah.
Maybe we train, you know, like a dog, we learn to sit still, or we learn to not think, or we learn to think more sharply. But there's nothing to learn from them. And so therefore, they always say Buddhism is a bunch of training, like you train a horse or a dog or something. Because we've had a lot of education in our universities and gymnasiums and in schools, and we're still miserable and we don't know what the hell is going on.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we think education is useless. Mm. But actually, Buddhism is education. It's a different higher education. Adi Shiksha is the Sanskrit word. It's a higher education where you educate your emotions, you educate your mind, you educate yourself, you discover the physical nature of reality, which is relativity. And emptiness is there's no absolute that reality hides in or you can run away from reality into. The absolute is this relativity. So you have to just hang out and you have to make it better with other people. Now, the thing about the burnout thing, and you mentioned righteousness and so forth, the human being has a tendency to put their ideas ahead of their experience. You know, like they make dogmas out of their theories, and then they sacrifice even life on top of a theory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's wrong. Buddhism is like the good side of modern science, in that Buddha always said, I think he's so cool, actually. Buddha is really cool. He says he sits up one morning, he really feels happy. He says, wow, I'm so happy. I know everything, and I feel great. I really feel great. And you, I know that you can know it too, but I'm so sorry, I can't really explain it to you.
Because it's quite a bummer.
It's beyond words.
Yeah.
I can give you a way, though, you can experience it. You can practice some methods, and you can sharpen your mind and sharpen your attention and sharpen your mindfulness and your insight. And then you have the genius to realize it. In other words, he challenged what we, when I was a little boy, when I was a student in school, I really didn't like. In the church, they tell you, well, you can't understand. You just have to believe what we tell you.
Yeah.
But God understands, but you're not going to ever understand. That's the way you are. You just don't understand. And I said, well, that's ridiculous. I said, what's the point of that? Why should I believe something for no reason? If I believe something for no reason, I'll believe anything.
Mm.
Right? So I rejected that. Then you go to the science people and say, oh, yeah, you can analyze this molecule and this thing and that and the other. But of course, the more you discover about it, the more you will know you don't know.
Yeah.
So you'll never understand everything anyway. But hell, go at it. You go at it, some little piece of it, and make some money, make a drug or do something, invent something. And I didn't like that either. And what I loved when I encountered the Buddhist educational tradition was, they say, not only can you understand yourself and the world, but if you want to be happy, you have to understand it. And actually, it took me a long time to realize what is the foundation of that assurance. And the foundation of it is that the Buddha supposedly is a person who did understand reality fully. And what he understood was reality is freedom from suffering. Reality is bliss and happiness. So the more you know of reality, the happier you will be.
It doesn't appear to be the experience of everyday people, though, right?
That's right. But that's because they don't know what it is. Everyday people don't know what is real. They think that they're the realest thing, for example.
Yeah.
I'm the realest, and everybody else is not real. And then once they think that, since the universe doesn't agree with them, that they're more real than everything else, they suffer because they're fighting something. They're struggling with it, you know? And that was then Buddha's predicament. Once he was so happy, and once he realized that reality is happiness, if you fully merge with it and know what it is, it's happiness. You know, his Four Noble Truths, for example, people have misunderstood. He said, if you don't know reality, if you're unenlightened, you will suffer.
Yeah, which usually it's like life is suffering, right?
That's right. So but it's the unenlightened life is suffering. See, it was less pessimistic than Socrates, who said the unexamined life is not worth living. Buddha never said that. Life is very much worth living because we are these intelligent animals that have the ability to understand ourselves, which is like really awesome. You know, crocodile can't really understand. They can eat that thing in front of them, but they're not going to really figure out their cosmic reality. Do you know what I mean? The crocodile. In a way, they're part of cosmic reality, but they can't understand that. So then when the crocodile evolves and the lucky crocodile becomes a human. And then they do understand. And even they understand they were crocodiles at some time. And so they are not too much against crocodile. But they also don't fantasize that it's great to be a crocodile. They realize crocodile has quite a lot of suffering because it's more ignorant than a human. So that was Buddha's thing. And he says, wow, everything's great. And even he saw that everybody else, even crocodiles, are great. But then he realized that when they don't know that, they suffer. And so the first noble truth is that if you're unenlightened, you'll suffer. But that doesn't mean it's not worth doing. It's worth because you can become enlightened. And the reason for that is that you exaggerate your own sense of reality.
Mm-hmm.
As my old Mongolian used to say, people are correct when they think they're real, but where they're wrong is where they think they're really real.
Mm-hmm.
And then especially, we all think we're more real than the other person. And then the other person disagrees with that and they think they're more real than us.
So when you say we think we're more real than the other person, you're talking about the feeling that like me and my experience is like the ultimate thing that's going on here.
That's right.
But then there's people, right, who say, oh, you know, I'm really not that important. I'm putting everyone else and everybody else is suffering first. And I'm until, you know, everybody has equal rights and until all that stuff, I'm going to just put myself out there completely, work for that cause.
Yes.
You know, how...
It's really nice of them. But the thing is, if they do it on the basis of like categorical imperative or something, but then secretly, really still inside, they still think they are the one.
Like saying, I should do that.
Yeah. They're driving themselves in a certain way by an ideology. And they still haven't really had the experience of being open to everyone else and connected to everyone else. And they're not really empathic to everybody else. They don't really feel the other people's suffering. And in a way, because they're suffering and they're putting themselves out, they get a little subliminally, even as humble as they say they may be, they think a little bit better than the other one because they're the one who's helping.
Mm.
And then because the real compassion has to be only based on wisdom, on knowing your own open-heartedness and knowing your connection to the other person. Just like, for example, you put your hand on a hot pot on your stove and you don't say, shall I be nice to my hand today and take it off? You don't say that. You just take it off. And so if you get where you can feel the other person because you're so open, you open your heart in a certain way, and then you draw the energy from their need for the help, and then you have this infinite energy of other beings' need. So you're not forcing yourself to do something and then later burning out and feeling I was a big martyr and it didn't do any good and there's still so many more people suffering.
Yeah.
Oh God. And though, you know, in other words, there's also something called in Buddhist psychology, there's something called the pride of humility.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. I'm so humble, you know. But still you think you're the most important, you know. You know, that's the pride of humility. Mm. You know?
So what's how do you cure that? Like, how do you cure that condition?
You realize what you are. And when you realize what you are is this super intelligent, super sensitive being that can really discover one's own inner freedom from being absolutely this or that. And then find out that the boundary between oneself and other is more or less by design. It isn't anything absolute either. Then the more you do that, the more open and empathic you become. You know, Mitleid?
Mitgefühl?
Compassion
or?
Yeah. But you feel Mitfühlen.
Mitgefühl.
Mitgefühl. That's Mitgefühl. Mitgefühl. Yeah. You get this Mitgefühl, and you actually Mitgefühl. You feel with that they feel, and then. Luckily, the more open-hearted like you are, the stronger you are, actually, because the stronger the inner bliss and happiness you have, so you can bear to feel the feeling of that. And then similarly also, you know, we have a way of seeing another the way we feel we are.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, when you are in love, when you are feeling inner bliss, like you're so beloved and you love that beloved, when you see other people, they look more beautiful to you and you sort of see the happiness side of them.
Mm-hmm.
Even they're kind of, and then you like, you become like a good parent or you become a good lover and like your lover is like a little down and you're kind of really good at cheering them up because you say, well, you're kind of down, but you know, I can see you grinning. And do you know what I mean? You can tease them out of their moping because you begin to see that they have the potential in them of happiness because every being does actually. And
so it's like even a responsibility to develop your own happiness.
That's the highest one.
In order to provide that.
That's right.
For people.
And you there is one form of Buddhism, Buddhist education, that doesn't want to oppress people into the non-duality vision because it's too hard for people. They just see all the suffering and they think, how could this be nirvana? How could this be like bliss, you know,
the non-duality.
Too miserable. There's a bunch of people starving here or burning in a fire or whatever. This ridiculous. This could be. So they can't see that. So then to those people, there's a form of the education where there's a place where you get free of it. But and then what happens is they sort of don't get despaired by what they see and they try to open themselves more and they at least get themselves happy, but they don't get that happy because actually your own desire for happiness is not as strong as 100 people's desire for happiness. 100 people's desire for happiness, the more you open to it, gives you a much greater power. And because you want to, you know, it's like, you know, the marathon runner in ancient Greece who ran from Marathon where the Persians were coming, you know, Xerxes or somebody was, Canastali was coming, and then he wanted to save Athens and his, you know, his family and his friends and his patriots, compatriots. So he ran beyond the capability of his body, and he gave the message, the Persians are coming, get ready, and then died. Because he actually broke his body because his love for his country was stronger than his the ability of his body. You know, his mind was more powerful than his body. And then there's the famous story of the Japanese and why they were disqualified from World Crew competition. You don't know that story? Well, there one time they got really close, and they do have big Japanese. And they got really close to beating the Cambridge crew shell, you know, the eight-man rowing thing, you know. And they were within like a foot of losing to them and in a big race, you know. And then as they floated over the line, two or three of the members of the eight crew dropped dead. They burst blood vessels in their head or something, you know. And so then they were disqualified because they're so gung-ho when they get together that they, again, they outdo the capacity of their body, you know, with their will. To win the race, you know. So the sort of the expansion of identification that the human being has, and the ability to a person, to a parent with a child, you know, members of a family with each other, war buddies in a platoon, in a battle, you know, people on teammates on a soccer field, you know, then lovers, you know, during the honeymoon at least, they identify with each other. And, you know, this is special human ability. And so the bodhisattva, who wants to be a Buddha, and then the Buddha, by definition, is a being that has expanded that identification limitlessly. Bodhisattva has expanded it tremendously, and then a Buddha limitlessly, which again gets into the area of like being almost inconceivable. And that gives them more courage and more strength and more energy to even be more happy themselves. Because then you say, okay, I love you. So what does that mean? In the Buddhist education, what I love you means is I want you to be happy. I have a will to your happiness. And then how could that have any meaning if you don't have some happiness yourself?
That's
have
key.
You had someone say, I love you and I'm totally miserable without you?
Sure.
And oh, you have, oh good. Well, that must have been fun. But on the other hand,
it was like semi-fun.
Did you want to be supplying their happiness?
Or their misery, like, you know?
Well, no, because it's much more fun if someone who's really happy then initially wants to love you.
Sure.
And wants you to be happy.
Sure.
So, in fact, that is how love, that's where the power of love comes, is from the happiness of the lover wanting the beloved to be as happy or more even, you know, and then from that increases infinitely, you know. Love being the strong force of the universe in Buddha's discovery is that. That's what his discovery is. His discovery really is nirvana. Not that unenlightened people will suffer. It's that it's possible to be enlightened and have nirvana and live nirvana.
So what is that nirvana?
What is it? Freedom. It's nirvana is total freedom from suffering. And then it's what is the minimalist way of saying, because Buddha was smart. If you go around promising people bliss, they think you're trying to sell them a drug or you're trying to con them or something. Because, you know, they think they know it's all miserable. And so initially he just said freedom from suffering. That was his minimalist thing. And later when it gets up into the esoteric things, like tantra and things like that, he says it's bliss, freedom, indivisible. Mm-hmm. That's what the nirvana is. And this is nirvana right here, supposedly.
Yeah, that's...
I don't quite have a full feeling for it yet, but I've sort of had a taste and I think it is the case.
That's something to wrap your head around, right? It's something to wrap your head around.
Yeah.
To say, well, this world that we're living in with everything that's going on, this actually is nirvana.
That's right.
But we have, like, we can't see it.
Well, that's because of ignorance, you see. If we, the more we investigate it, we will find its reality. And then people, many, not just Buddha, but many people, millions of people went ahead of us and they did discover that reality. And they gave us all kinds of educational methods of how to do it.
Can you give me one example of how would you investigate that?
How?
Yes.
Well, just like anything, you would put it under analysis. You would analyze it. So what is it? Okay. Okay, here is me. I'm a miserable person. I feel dissatisfied all the time. I'm this and that. Oh, well, really? Is that really my fixed way of being? It's my habit of always wanting some more and always evaluating what I have and never being content with it. Okay. So therefore, I wouldn't agree that this is bliss, because I think bliss is something I have to get. I have moments of it, then I want more. Okay. So if I investigate that, I look at, well, who's really wanting that? Who am I? What am I? And then is this habit, am I stuck in this habit? And anything that you investigate, according to their scientific tradition and discovery, it will dissolve under your analysis.
You know, when you talk about Buddhism with people, it's like, oh yeah, you know, it's like a philosophy. And it's like, no, it's not really a philosophy. You know what I mean? Oh, it's a religion. No, it's not really religion. And then people are like, oh yeah, I like mindfulness, right? I like basic meditation, which is great, right?
Yes.
Fantastic. Okay. It's not even that I think about it, but it seems like it's also something that has a lot to do with opening up something like a great creativity.
Oh, absolutely. Totally. I mean, I'm saying absolutely, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
But that's the thing. You see, the wisdom opens you up from any dogmatic conviction, any like fixation on any ideology or even on a theory. You know, modern science is the same as Buddhist science in that theory is always subject to revision by experience. You know, it's a hypothesis awaiting falsification or verification, depending. And so
this very much is not religion-like.
Yes, it's not religion. The great celebratory verse about the Buddha, Om ye dharma hetu prabhava hetun tesham tadagata hiyavadat tesham chayu nirodho evam vadi mahasramaniye swaha. What that means is, of those things that arise from causes, the Buddha said, what are the causes and also how they get to be ceased. And that was what he advocated. That such was the path that he advocated, the great wanderer, you could say, or the great seeker, Mahasramana. I actually like to translate it, the great vacationer, because he was
on vacation.
Yeah. Forever, you know. So yeah, that's it. That's the thing. So, you know, the wrong way of teaching Buddhism is that somehow it's irrational, it's mystical, you throw away your reason, which is all the Westerners are more rational, which is not true. But they think they are. And that didn't help us. So we throw that away. And now we're going to meditate and we're not going to think. And we're going to just experience without thinking. You know? And then what that leads to, and some gurus encourage that because they don't want those students to think that they're not getting anywhere and that the guru sucks, because they want like BMWs and they want to be served and they want a bunch of adulation from the students. So the less they think, the better. If they think after a month or two of this, like, what is this? Like, why am I doing this? You know, and I don't feel much better, you know?
Mm.
And then they'll look for more.
Mm.
So that's the thing.
When it comes to guru or teacher, right?
Yeah.
So many people will hear this, maybe. Hopefully people will hear this and think, okay, I want to experience this. I want to explore. I want to, you know?
That's good.
And a lot of people are then going to say, maybe, hopefully, I'm looking for someone to teach me this. And you said something really nice. I hope you can say it again. What qualifies for a good teacher, or like, how do you find a good teacher? Like, or you know, a teacher, Lehrerin, right?
Yeah.
Like, how do you find, like, what are the qualities to look for in someone, because there are so many people out there and there are so many labels and so many signs on the doorbell, like, oh, I teach just meditation and that one, and this is the truth, and this is the mystical this and that.
Yes.
Is there something you would recommend? Like, how would you find, or what are the qualities you would be looking for?
Well, you know, what do you look for when you seek an education? You know, you seek an education, say you want to be a chemist or you want to be a computer scientist. So you look for someone who's knowledgeable about computer science and you take that course. But you don't necessarily, if you come to a computer science teacher and that teacher says, only I know computer science and don't ever study with anybody else ever, and just reciting me, then you would be a little suspicious about that. because there's a lot of faculties of computer science. So if you someone, well, but here you here's a book and here's this and here's a look and you try that, and that's great, you know. So I always give students a rule of thumb, which is if you meet people who are teaching something and you're learning from them and it seems to make sense to you and it seems that when you try to put it into your mind and practice, it seems to open up some doors for you, then that's very good. And particularly if that person is happy to share with you what they know, and they also are perfectly happy when you go study some other thing. And so they're sort of relaxed about it. They don't seem to be too needy about you. But if you meet the one who says, ah, it's your karma, I'm your destined guru, one-stop shopping, everything here, don't go talk to anybody else, you might get confused, etc. Then that one you say, oh, thanks so much, that's so good, that's great, thanks a lot, goodbye. That's the rule of thumb that I give. And you know, the guru thing in Tibetan system has become very confused. There is an initiatory role for a lama or a guru in a special context, but it doesn't mean some sort of excessive dependence. And but in a way, one is using that lama in the ceremonial way as a doorway to the Buddha, to the actual Buddha. You know, and it almost doesn't matter if the person is not perfect. And then when the person is in their civilian clothes, let's say, and they're driving down the street, if they say turn right down a one-way street, you can say, no, that's stupid. You know, you don't do something wrong from them. So someone should be ethical. They should walk their talk. They should not seem to be doing harmful. If there already is a group around someone, you look at the people in the group. If they seem very independent-minded and they have a friendly relation with the teacher, but they also have some respect because they learned something, but they're not real like slaves. Like the Rigbar organization recently blew up. Although there are plenty of them in Germany, I think also.
Yes, yes.
And they all blew up because finally they got sick of that teacher exploiting them and behaving badly. And then that's especially bad because actually some of the things he taught were useful. Some were not. The excessive anti-reason element is especially bad, an anti-learning element, and acting like you just empty your mind and stare at the guru. That's no good, that side. But still, some things that came through that person were useful. So they don't want to throw out whatever they lose of value because they dislike the bad things the person did. You know. But that's how you have to be more mature to be able to do that. They tend to turn against the whole thing when somebody abuses them. Like
yeah, it happens right now. You know? Yes.
And that can be forestalled by people learning and studying and realizing this is like an educational process. You know, people don't go to study chemistry or become a computer scientist by some guy on the faculty who says, oh, you don't have to take 101 and 201 and 301 and then advanced seminar. Just come to advanced seminar and just look at me in the seminar, and you'll be perfect computer scientist. Nobody would think that was the case. That's ridiculous. And yet that's the way they behave. Those guys. You just depend on the lama. You don't have to learn anything. And I've known people who were dependent on some lama for 30 years, and yeah. They still don't know anything.
Yeah.
So that's really an abuse.
Maybe that's because that whole thing still has a veil of mystery.
That's right.
It's like, oh, the meditation and the secret
exoticism,
and so on, you know?
Yes.
Do you think do you think it's necessary to sort of get rid of that veil, get rid of that thing?
Or yeah, to get rid of it ahead of time and find out what's going on as much as possible. Like, especially when people first hear about it, they get excited and they say, I need a teacher. Then you say, that's a mistake. If you need a teacher, you probably don't need a teacher. What you do is need to learn more. And then when you've learned a lot and you have a real way of evaluating different possible teachers, and there are some exceptional cases, like I did meet my teacher, just I immediately knew that was I was terrified in a way. I was completely drawn. And then that person immediately taught me a bunch of stuff. And he said he's not my guru. He's just going to teach me a language. You know, he was stepped out of the domination game. You know, and the Dalai Lama does that. He's so great in that sense. You know, he can give a ritual and he's very majestic with his gestures and recites a mantra. And then he's out there chuckling and cracking a dirty joke or whatever and shaking hands and being perfectly normal, and nobody has to blow a horn, act like it's some big deal with him. And then when he goes to a hotel or something, he's visiting somewhere to teach, he goes and meets all the dishwashers and stuff. And it's just as nice to them as he is to the whatever. Yeah. Goes to the White House, he digs the security guy. And when he went to the Bush Senior House in New York, I mean in Washington, Millie the dog ran away with him because they were paranoid about the Chinese, so they didn't let him go out the front door. So he went out a little back elevator from the kitchen, and they didn't notice that the dog got in the elevator with him. And then the dog was running across the lawn because they didn't want the photograph of him leaving the White House to show the Chinese so they wouldn't be mad. Bush Senior was a big, you know, thing about the Chinese. And so, and they had the Secret Service guys were running to try to catch the dog. The dog wanted to go see Dalai Lama. Dalai Lama's not going to pick her up by the ears. Millie, her name is Millie the dog. So anyway, so I like that. So we can do, you can, we can do more podcasts. I can do you a podcast also. I will interview you on Skype or on Zoom or something, okay?
I would love that.
Yeah. I like to do that.
Totally. I
have a podcast, lots of them.
I know that. You know, this is true. I'm not saying this to put like honey on your honey on your belly or something. But
no.
When people ask me, it's like, okay, so we like your podcast. Like, what should we do if we want to learn more about Buddhism? Literally, always the first thing I say is listen to the Bob Thurman.
Oh, good, wonderful.
So,
okay, well, you got it. But you have your own art and you have your own special knowledge, and you found your way here. And so I want to do a podcast with you in the future. I'll do more with you if you want. You know,
I would love
to. Question.
Yes, beautiful.
On Skype, you know, from Woodstock.
Perfect.
I love it. Thank you. I love it.
Thank you very much for the time.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, really.
Ich bedanke mich von Herzen, dass ihr heute wieder dabei wart. Dieser Podcast wird produziert von mir, Audio- und Video-Editing sowie Ausspielung von Robert Schulz, Backoffice und Organisation von Becky Willecke. Ihr erreicht uns unter coaching@curse.de und alle Infos zu dieser Episode und allem Weiteren findet ihr in den Shownotes.